This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick, coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta took the oath of office for his second term amid continued political tension following a long election season. Meanwhile, in another part of town, the opposition held a competing prayer rally for its leader, Raila Odinga. The day kicked off with tear gas fired at both events.
That's VOA's Jill Craig reporting from Nairobi, Kenya. We'll have the full details for you coming up.
Also, with a new president, Zimbabwe struggles with a troubled past. French President Emmanuel Macron met today with Burkina Faso president as part of a three-nation African tour. And the deaths of four U.S. Special Forces soldiers in Niger last month have raised questions about America's role in the fight against violent extremism in a sparsely populated region of Africa.
We'll have these stories and more for you, so do stay tuned. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta took the oath of office for his second term amid continued political tension following a long election season. Meanwhile, in another part of town, the opposition held a competing prayer rally for its leader, Raila Odinga. The day kicked off with tear gas fired at both events. VOA's Jill Craig has more from Nairobi.
Please repeat after me. I,
Uhuru Kenyatta.
After two presidential elections, several Supreme Court petitions, frequent protests, and daily developments, Kenya finally inaugurated its president, incumbent Uhuru Kenyatta, on Tuesday at a sports stadium in Nairobi.
I undertake today to be the custodian of the dreams of all and to be the keeper of the aspirations of those who voted for me and those who did not. I will be president of all.
After his August electoral win was nullified, Kenyatta won a second election in October with about 98% of the overall vote, after opposition leader Raila Odinga told his supporters to boycott the polls. There was 39% overall voter turnout in October, leading some to ask whether Kenyatta had earned a mandate. Nick Othiambo is a fisherman who traveled from the opposition stronghold of Western Kenya to show his support for Kenyatta Tuesday. He voted for him in the August election, but was unable to do so again in October after the Electoral Commission deemed his area too insecure to conduct polling.
I've come here to show my solidarity with the Excellency President Uhuru Kenyatta and the Deputy President, even though my region could not vote because of some election violence. But I've come here to represent my people and to show that we are together with the Excellency, the President of Kenya.
During his inauguration, Kenyatta promised he would target 100% universal health care, facilitate affordable housing, and attract investment. He said any African wishing to visit Kenya would be eligible to get a visa on arrival, and East Africans would be given many of the same privileges as Kenyans, like working, conducting business, owning property, and marrying and settling in the country. Several people were hurt in a stampede outside the stadium when they tried to force their way inside the venue. Police fired tear gas to control the crowd. And on the outskirts of Nairobi, police fired tear gas at opposition supporters who had gathered for a so-called prayer rally held to coincide with the inauguration. The demonstrations quickly devolved into unrest, and at least one man was killed. Speaking Swahili to his supporters, Odinga suggested that the opposition would be conducting its own inauguration in December. He says, "We have said this month on 12 December we'll be having the People's Assembly which will swear me in." At Kenyatta's inauguration, leaders from Rwanda, Uganda, Botswana, Zambia, Ethiopia, Somalia, South Sudan, Gabon, Djibouti, and Namibia were in attendance. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Thank you, Jill. And to get a feel for the mood on the ground, we have in studio with us today BMJ of VOA's Swahili service. Thank you for joining us, BMJ.
Thank you.
Well, what is the mood on the ground, first of all, for supporters of President Kenyatta?
I must say that it was ecstatic for the supporters of Uhuru Kenyatta all over the country. And beginning with, as you heard there, with Geo Craig, our reporter in Nairobi, beginning with Kasarani Stadium, where they had started streaming in as early as 4 o'clock in the morning. Those are his supporters, and that was expected. But I'm thinking you might want to ask me about the other side of the of
exactly. The that was going to be my next question, because meanwhile, we have supporters of Raila Odinga, the opposition leader, who has rallied his people really today, I understand, for a prayer vigil. So why is he doing this?
Now, there's a long history of the reasons, many reasons why he wanted to do this. First of all, he's seeking attention because he believes that if he does something that coincides with the swearing in of Uhuru Kenyatta, then it will be something that people will pay more attention to. I'm not sure that that worked, but the service that you're talking about was actually going to be like a memorial service, and he thought that it would resonate with the people because it was going to be a prayer meeting for people who died during the altercation between his supporters and the police. Now, this was, you know, following his, if you remember, he was here in the United States, and when he went back, he was met by many people, and there was that fight, and many people died, and the police, Kenyan police, have confirmed that. So he was going to do that as a way of showing that, first of all, Uhuru Kenyatta was not elected according to the Constitution of Kenya.
Now, of course, we all know that he did go to the Supreme Court, which did grant this new re-election, and he did not participate in that election. So why then is he continuing this, though he did not participate when he had the opportunity to?
Now, he has given his reasons for that, that he was not going to involve himself in an exercise which he says was going to be conducted by the same people who had bungled the election of August the 8th. And he wanted many changes introduced, you know, through along the way. But there were constraints of time, according to the electoral body, the Electoral and Boundaries Commission. And that is the reason they say they were going to go ahead and carry out the election. Now, one thing has stood out, that after some people went to court to challenge the election of the 26th of October, the same judge, the Chief Justice who presided over the first petition which nullified Kenyatta's election, is the same one who has said that this election was valid. And that leaves Raila Odinga, in my thinking, in a kind of a tight spot, where now the Supreme Court has said it was good, and the IBC has said it was good. And remember that Raila Odinga and NASA, the opposition coalition, does not have the muscle that he might use, he would otherwise use in parliament, because they don't have as many members of parliament. And therefore, it's a wait-and-see kind of game.
So with these actions that he is doing, some could perceive this as being counterproductive to keep people riled up. But on the other hand, of course, he has the right to do this. So what is really going to be the solution for him?
Now, the there are people who think that Uhuru Kenyatta, the president now, is supposed to, would reach out. And as a matter of fact, in his speech today, he was very emphatic on the fact that he wants to reach out and try to unify this nation, which is really quite divided along not only political lines, but tribal lines. So the solution, according to the many analysts that I personally have spoken to, is to get together and try to find a ground that is common ground so that the country can move forward. And I think you heard there Jill Craig saying that Raila Odinga has now again said that he will be sworn in as a president in December.
So that's really quite interesting. So then I guess the first priority for the president, President Kenyatta, would be to reach out to Mr. Odinga. And if that does not fare well, then what would be the next step?
The next step would be just to observe and see, but I think there will be some backlash if that does not happen. Because remember, this is a country that is half divided by half in terms of the supporters of both sides, and so there has to be a way of getting together and at least having an agreement of some sort in order for the country to move forward.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for this very interesting perspective on the situation. That was VOA Swahili Service BMJ joining us today in the studio.
Thank you.
For 37 years under the iron-fisted rule of Robert Mugabe, Zimbabwe was battered by human rights abuses, endemic corruption and mismanagement that sank the economy and reduced the nation's once strong agricultural sector to ruins. The nation's new president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, sees only one way forward for his country: forgiveness. In his inaugural address last week, he described Mugabe as a mentor and father, but urged Zimbabweans to let bygones be bygones. Mugabe's government, in which Mnangagwa served as vice president, was repeatedly accused of rigging elections, using force against opposition parties, jailing, beating and torturing critics, and other human rights violations. Corruption grew especially intense after diamond fields were discovered in 2006. Today, Mnangagwa announced his government would allow a three-month amnesty for those willing to return state funds they took during the previous administration. He said the government would arrest all of those who do not comply with this directive. But just a day after the new president urged his nation to let go, the state jailed former Mugabe-era minister Ignatius Chombo on massive corruption charges. He is one of several Mugabe cronies to face what some critics are saying is political retribution, not true justice.
French President Emmanuel Macron is in Burkina Faso on his first trip to Africa, hoping to redefine his country's relationship with the continent. Addressing university students in Ouagadougou, Macron said he belongs to a new generation of French leaders who will build partnerships with Africa rather than tell it what to do. But after decades of an often tense France-Africa relationship, there's still lingering hostility. Youths protested against Macron pelting stones at one of his delegation's vehicles. There was botched grenade attack on French troops just hours before Macron's arrival in the capital. The French president was subjected to rowdy student questions at the university after his speech, and he struggled to get his answers heard above the noisy crowd. Macron is on a three-day visit to Burkina Faso, Ghana, and Ivory Coast, aimed at boosting cooperation between France and those African countries in education, migration, and the digital economy.
The deaths of four U.S. Special Forces soldiers in Niger last month have raised questions about America's role in the fight against violent extremism in a sparsely populated region of Africa. Before the October attack, in which at least four Nigerian soldiers were also killed, some members of Congress said they were aware of U.S. Operations in Niger, but others, including Senator Lindsey Graham, the Republican of South Carolina, and Senator Chuck Schumer, the Democrat of New York, said they did not know U.S. troops were on the ground in Niger. U.S. involvement includes more than 800 troops, according to Pentagon officials. There are also two drone bases in the country. Niger and Burkina Faso want the U.S. to do more to support local governments in their fight against extremism, mainly by funding a new regional task force. The first-year operating budget for the five-nation force has been projected at $500 million. The United States is considering making a contribution of $60 million.
19 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The Burundi Truth and Reconciliation Commission says that it has uncovered 4 mass graves. The revelation comes as the government-appointed body is working to bring Burundians together after decades of civil war between the country's 2 ethnic groups, the Hutu and Tutsi. Moses Habyarimana takes a look at efforts to bring the country's warring parties together.
The country's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was formed in 2014, aims to reconcile all citizens who have lived through 50 years of conflict. Over the decades, nearly 300,000 people died since independence from Belgium in 1962. War came to an end between Hutu and the Tutsi in 2006, with the signing of the Arusha Agreement 6 years earlier. But conflict resumed 2 years ago. That's when President Pierre Nkurunziza ran for a 3rd term, a move that the opposition says was unconstitutional. Activists are depending on the commission to restore peace in the country. Burundian Human Rights Minister Martin Livyabandi explains that the board is part of the Arusha Accord.
The commission is independent, and as a government, we can't not give injunction to that commission. But really, the operation made by the commission is very important and is more helpful for the reconciling population of Burundi. You know, Burundi, we passed through difficulties.
The chairman of the commission, Jean-Louis Nahimana, said that the body consulted with more than 2,300 citizens in Muramvya province about the bodies that have been found between 1962 and 1993.
Le nombre de personnes assassinées ou disparues, nous avons pu identifier.
He says that the commission has so far identified 17,434 people who were assassinated or disappeared during the civil war in Muramvya province, and that an estimated 1,881 people were involved in the killings of civilians. According to the commission, a staggering 697 mass graves reported by Burundians are yet to be exhumed. However, some Burundians feel that the board could be more effective. Some civil society groups and activists criticized it for failing to include their members in identifying the mass graves and reconciling Burundians. They say it is too affiliated to the government and should be independent. A university professor in Burundi who preferred not to reveal his name says that the commission is biased.
Ethnically, it's not balanced. There are some Tutsis, it's true, in the commission, but those guys are like objects. They are useless. They are objects of the ruling party, of the Hutu majority.
Agathon Rwasa is a opposition leader and the deputy speaker of the parliament. He says the commission serves an important purpose, promoting forgiveness.
But I think the big dimension that must be handled is forgiveness. Because whatever we can do, if one could just think that he will revenge or will do this or will do that, we won't get back those who already passed away.
According to the commission, 472 victims have been able to forgive and reconcile with those who harmed them over the past 55 years. Observers hope that the political reconciliation and cooperation today, as the Arusha Accords 20 years ago, will prevent a return of the large-scale atrocities of Burundi's decades of civil war. Moses Habyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
A recent public opinion survey showed that 60% of Tunisians plan to vote in municipal elections, but 56% have zero confidence in the country's political parties. And experts are warning that the emerging democracy in North Africa has to be more responsive to its people. Mohamed El-Shenawi has the story.
The Muraqibun Network, or Watchers, is a Tunisian organization that monitors the country's post-revolution situation. The network's recent public opinion survey on Tunisians' perceptions about their political system and their country are not encouraging. One major finding is that more than 64% of those surveyed strongly think Tunisia is on the wrong path. Sarah Yerkes, a fellow at the Carnegie Middle East program, explains why.
The primary explanation is that the demands of the revolution have not been met. The economy is worse off today than it was in 2010, particularly for young people who have extremely high levels of unemployment. There's still a sense of insecurity among the public. So the public, frankly, just don't trust the government to deliver the economic and security needs that they fought for during the revolution.
Sheikh Abdel Fattah Mourou is the vice president of the Tunisian parliament and vice president of the Ennahda party. He says those demands may actually have hampered the work of consecutive Tunisian governments.
الثورة اصطحبت بمطلبية شديدة. وهذه المطلبية أرهقت الحكومة.
The revolution has created very high unrealistic demands and expectations, which forced the government to accept many concessions, especially in terms of salaries, and hiring more people. We have seen in some sectors increases of 20% per year, which means that the salaries in many sectors have more than doubled in the last 5 years or 6 years. So these have created huge budgetary constraints on the government and do not allow the government to focus on what is really needed in terms of changes in the economy or in investments or infrastructure.
Sheikh Mourou said responding to public pressure has created huge budgetary constraints that prevented the government from focusing on economic reform or investing in job creation and infrastructure. Scott Mastick, Regional Director for the Middle East and North Africa at the International Republican Institute, disagrees with that argument. He says the government should have had a vision.
The public needs to see that the government has a clear plan with respect to economic opportunity. So a few high-profile initiatives that help restore some public confidence that the government understands the challenges everyday people face and is taking seriously the need to create some jobs for Tunisian citizens, I think is a really important thing.
The Muraqibun survey also shows that 57% of Tunisians think municipal elections will improve things. Fadl Ali Reza is a Tunisian journalist and researcher. He says the zero confidence in Tunisian political parties is a clear indication of lost trust in the central coalition government. However, he says believing in local governments is a good sign.
That's encouraging in terms of some sort of residual faith in electoral mechanism of democracy to translate into forms of government that can respond to people's needs. So at the municipal level, the people see the roads that are in poor condition, little or bad lighting, and these are all very visible indicators that government is not responding to constituents.
Nevertheless, Ali Reza is not sure municipal elections will ever take place because the coalition government has postponed them several times. They were to have been held in 2016, then were postponed to early this year and delayed again until December. The government has since pushed them back to March of next year. Ali Reza says that indicates the coalition government is reluctant to hold municipal elections for fear they could weaken the central government. Mohammed Al-Shinawi, VOA News, Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News. That's coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Linor Mudu. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.